Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. Water, water everywhere, and many drops to drink. A proposal receiving not just a little interest would ship fresh water to California from Alaska. We'll have the story. Also this time, a gardener's gift-giving guide. It's easy. And Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt responds to critics who say he compromises too much.
Science helps, but science is not absolute. And what I try to do is just get out there and mix it up and try to arrive at thoughtful, reasonable judgments.
The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson.
Basically, the approach is to use single hull tankers or bag technology. Bag technology is currently in use in some parts of the world to haul fresh water, to move approximately 1 million acre-feet of water from southeast Alaska in drainages that have 150 to 400 inches of precipitation a year, down the coast to coastal communities in California and Mexico.
Rick Davidge, Chief of Water Resources at the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, speaking to us from Anchorage. The plan to bring water from Alaska south has been under proposal for a number of years. In reviewing the original proposal to build an underwater pipeline to bring the water, the Federal Office of Technology Assessment rejected the plan as too costly and environmentally dangerous. Instead, it was suggested bringing water south by tanker ship might be the better way to go. And Davidge is convinced it can be done.
We believe that it can be done economically, feasibly. One, even using the single-hull tankers, we can deliver water at about $2,000 an acre-foot, which is less than the desal cost of water, higher quality water.
You're talking about the desalination process of taking seawater and making it potable.
Yeah, one of the, and if you look at the tanker, the use of tankers, that is a competitive price. The bottom line is what quality of water for what amount of money do you get. The desal puts out water that has about 700 TDS salt in it. The water from Alaska has about 50, and it's mainly minerals and non-salts. So you get much higher quality water for much less cost. The other thing is one tanker can deliver more water at lower cost than the largest saltwater desalinization plant can produce in the United States.
Well, give us a better, for instance, on that. A typical size, I imagine you're talking about the super tankers of the size that we haul crude oil in.
Yeah, we're talking about very large crude carriers or VLCC tankers.
So how much water could be delivered in a tanker of that size?
One tanker can haul between 250 to 300 acre-feet. And one tanker can deliver upwards of about 11,000 acre-feet a year.
Now, that's the amount of water that it takes to cover 1 acre in a depth of 1 foot. For our listeners, tell us how many, say, typical households might that serve?
Well, one tanker would carry about 250 to 300 acre-feet. One tanker could deliver in a year about 11,000 acre-feet of water, and that would supply about 7 million homes a year.
Now, Let's start at the beginning of this cycle, then. If this were possible to ship the water south to areas that need it, how are you proposing to obtain this? First of all, where would it come from, and how would you get it?
Well, in southeast Alaska, we have a rainforest. We have a tremendous amount of discharge. We have well over a trillion acre-feet of water discharged from the state of Alaska into the ocean annually. The take of about 1 million acre-feet of water from a number of sources in southeast Alaska, statistically, you cannot find it. The discharge is so huge. Again, let me point out that the precipitation in most of these drainages is between 150 to 400 inches of water a year. And that's very difficult for people to imagine that it rains almost 365 days a year in many parts of southeast Alaska. But we have identified 21 specific sources that are of sufficient volume, of sufficient water quality, and at tidewater available to tankers that can meet that kind of demand. Now, we put 1 million acre feet as a ceiling, because technologically we think that's the limitation at this time. We do not see any serious environmental questions yet, but I will say that all of the studies are not in. There's still questions in some of the take sites with respect to impacts of freshwater-saltwater mix. Most of these cases, however, are water that do not have fish in them. The water is actually so clean that fish cannot live in the water. And you don't have long braided streams with interactive marshes and that kind of thing. You're looking at fjords that are very high, steep walls with huge mountains and glaciers on top with massive waterfalls falling into the ocean. So you're not looking at the kind of fish impact questions that you normally look at.
What about the actual collection process itself? Is that going to involve any kind of movement on the land surface,
no,
any kind of roads?
No.
Or
one of the things that Governor Hickel has made very clear and is that he is not interested in putting dams or big pipelines or pumping stations or that kind of thing onshore. We have been very aggressive in the application of bag technology as a static reservoir offshore that can fill over time and store the water very cost-effectively in some of these coves, and then the tankers can pull in and then pump the water off the bags. So there would be no onshore impact. In fact, we've made it clear that we don't even want to have any camps onshore. The other thing is these bags float just below the surface of the water, so if you're standing on shore looking across, you won't even see the bag. If you're up in the air in an airplane, you could see the bag.
These bags are made of a special nylon. When full, the bag itself may be towed by tugboat, or the water stored inside may be pumped aboard one of the supertankers. David says the plan would be most competitive against the desalination process. David says Alaska would provide the water for between $500 and $2,000 an acre foot. We contacted Tom Graff, an attorney with the Environmental Defense Fund in Oakland and a specialist in water issues. Is this, we asked him, a reasonable proposal, or is it the craziest thing you ever heard of?
Well, even at the height of the drought a couple of years ago, the most expensive water that was being sold was in California was $175 an acre foot, not counting delivery costs. So it's not a competitive price at this point on an everyday basis by any means. If one could really deliver it at $500 an acre foot, theoretically it would be substantially cheaper than desalination as an alternative. But that really is not the current technology of choice. The main way that urban areas who can afford to pay the most for water and California and elsewhere are going to get their water in the future is by voluntary purchases from farmers for whom the value of water at this point in time, maybe at the maximum, goes up to $100 an acre foot, particularly if they're not already in permanent crops, but are using the water for field crops. And there's a pretty big gap between 100 and 2,000, and there's still a big gap between 100 and 500.
What about your other objection or area of concern that you've touched on, the possibility of having some environmental negative effect of drawing so much fresh water out from its natural ecosystem and taking it someplace else? How important is that concern?
Well, I think one would have to look at any given proposal. I think it's probably not the big concern. The big concern will be cost. If the proponents of this kind of project or set of projects are intelligent about it, they would spread the environmental impact among several places and would try to minimize it at any given location. And if one were careful, I would think one could divert at least some fresh water from a number of streams without significant environmental impact if done carefully. So I think one would have to examine any given proposal carefully, but I don't think environmental impact is likely to be the concern that topples this program, if any does. I think cost will be the big issue.
David cites studies projecting many states in the West will run out of water in the next 20 years or so, not from drought, strictly speaking, but from increased demand, population growth. One wonders whether developing a water source from Alaska would encourage further growth in a region that geologically, hydrologically actually, cannot sustain it? Tom Graff says this is the wrong question.
Ultimately, economics are going to be what is most relevant in sorting this out. And one of the advantages of a proposal like this, where the stark choice is presented to potential water buyers, say in Los Angeles or San Diego, you can get water here for $2,000 an acre foot sign on the dotted line, and someone else points out there are farmers who are buying water in California still at $3 or $8 an acre foot. How come you're paying $2,000 while these other folks are paying $3 or $8? And you could probably go up and buy the water from them for $100. It does maybe slowly penetrate the public consciousness that we're misallocating the resource.
David says the Alaska State Legislature has already passed controlling legislation to regulate the interstate sale and transportation of the water, and they have already identified 21 places where this water might be obtained. In addition, says David, they have already received requests from various concerns in California for 450,000 acre-feet. Both David and Graff agree it is of concern, at least to investigate, whether extracting so much fresh water from a watery ecosystem would have any adverse effects. Would allowing the remaining water to become more saline thus endanger the plants, animals, fish, and waterfowl that live in the region? David indicates all that stands in the way of first shipments of this fresh water are more detailed contracts between supplier and purchaser. Water, the next Alaska crude. Imagine the scenario if the Exxon Valdez spilled water instead of oil when it ran aground on Bly Reef. This is Bruce Robertson. There is nothing like giving to someone you love or care about something that is both practical and personal. Personal as in you made it yourself. If the person receiving your gift happens to be a gardener, why, you are in luck. Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, says your gift list would be easy to fill. Not that we are in line for any gift, mind you, but we thought we'd stop by to see what we might have gotten had we been on the list. Okay, it's a kind of a cold and snowy day. Let's see if Larry's home. Larry!
Bruce,
hey,
come on in.
Hey, Larry, how you doing?
I'm all right. I'm just working on my Christmas list, so come on in and sit down and... You can.
Nice to come in out of the cold.
Yeah, you can join me for a cup of tea. I just made a pot of tea, too.
Oh, that's nice.
Here, have a chair right there.
Thanks. So what are you doing?
Well, I'm working on my Christmas list of presents that I like to give out to people at Christmas time, and I take a special interest in giving out garden-related Christmas gifts, as you would imagine. Now, this is... Let me pour you a cup of tea here first. And I've got some mint tea... And this is from mint that I grew in my garden. And, you know, you've been down there. You've seen the mint growing. And now it's in its form of tea. So here it is in its little jar. And it's all in there. Smells like mint.
Oh, yeah. Smells nice.
So this is one of the things that I like to give people for Christmas. Some herbs that I've dried, that I've grown, that I've dried. Mint is one that's very popular with people. I also like to make little potpourri bags out of lavender, which smells nice. You know, women can put it in their underwear drawer. That's something that I've done over the years. You know, something else you can do is make up some pesto in the summer and save it for Christmas. So there's a lot of herb things that you can do.
Your own making your own gifts.
Yes, yeah. Making my own gifts. And then I also have a list of things that I think are really good that are always on my list. Here's some honey if you want, but otherwise... And then a $50 gift certificate or a $25 gift certificate from a garden center or a nursery, I think, is a great Christmas gift, because then it, in the dead of winter, it gives people the feeling of springtime and renewal, and so it has that sort of seasonal philosophy to it. Now, another thing that I really think everybody should have is a real good set of pruners or hand pruners or secateurs, and I think you should get a bypass set of pruners. You see how the blades bypass each other there, as opposed to anvil pruners. Does a good job. These things can be expensive. They can be $30, $40, but it's a great gift and it'll last a long time. Here's something else I like to find for people that it's a folding saw, and everybody likes to have a little something like this. This will prune some of this larger. It's a nice gadget. People like gadgets for Christmas, so a nice pruning saw, that might cost you $20 or $25. Now, also, don't forget this. A nice pair of leather gloves.
Work gloves, definitely.
A nice pair of leather work gloves. Absolutely, you know, necessary in the garden.
I see you've got a list of catalog or a stack of catalogs here, Larry.
Yeah.
Is that something you're looking through?
Yes, and I just started doing this the last few years because my stepfather lives out in Illinois and my brother lives in Illinois, and it's easier for me to order something out of a catalog and send it straight to them. This is something I always I get. Here, let me show you a couple pages. Here. This is a sunflower seed wreath. This is a nice little wreath, about 8.5 inches in diameter, made out of sunflowers and other wild bird, you know, wild seeds that wild birds like to eat. So you can put this up in the house during the holidays and then put it outside for the birds as bird food later on.
And again, this is a catalog that there are so many of them on the market. You can find examples of this in many other catalogs.
Yeah, catalogs are good, but you can also find some of these things at your lawn and garden center.
Sure.
Now here's something else, birdhouse Christmas tree ornaments. We got so excited about those that my wife even made a couple this year. Look at these little Christmas
trees
we made.
That is really
cute. We went
out
in the backyard and gathered up some bark and some moss and got a little jigsaw and cut these things up. And you can see these things stand about 4 to 6 inches high, and they look like cute little birdhouses. You could use in a nativity scene, or you could use around your Christmas tree, or just put in any natural little setting you had around the house.
What else
now,
you got?
Well, while we're talking about birds, here's another gift, about $7. It's a little gift for a bird.
And so the holiday preparations continue. The ideas are endless, which is good, because your list is probably nearly so. Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. Larry is ready for the holiday season at his home in Hollowville, New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. In a recent editorial in the Washington Post, syndicated columnist and author Alexander Cockburn isolated the concerns of those critical of Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt. The headline read, "Bruce Babbitt, Compromised by Compromise." Writes Cockburn of Babbitt's central philosophy toward environmental protection, quote, "An ecosystem approach is just a piece of conceptual flimflam disguising dismemberment of existing environmental protections," end quote. At a recent Democratic Party political gathering in New Paltz, New York, north of New York City, Babbitt defended his use of compromise as the most useful and reliable tool available in the pursuit of environmental protection, whether in the Pacific Northwest ancient forests or the Florida Everglades.
Well, I think when we're dealing with these resource issues and trying to find the equilibrium between protection of the ecosystem and the sustainable use of the resource, that inevitably we're not going to please everybody, and there is surely an element of compromise in it. And on top of that, it's not the most exact science in the world. I mean, we know, for example, that the Pacific Northwest has been vastly overcut, that the clear-cutting is not appropriate, but exactly what is the sustainable timber yield that we can give to those communities to protect jobs at the same time that we're saying the ecosystem can remain diverse and strong in this context? That's a similar kind of issue in the Everglades. So the grazing issue is much the same. How much forage, how many cattle in the riparian areas are consistent with preserving the diversity, the vitality, the cleanliness of the landscape? Science helps, but science is not absolute. And what I try to do is just get out there and mix it up and try to arrive at thoughtful, reasonable judgments.
Columnist Cockburn is author of a new book, The Rise and Fall of the Clinton Administration, detailing the contrast between the promise and the accomplishments of the Clinton administration so far. Cockburn says this contrast is nowhere better seen than in the performance record of Interior Secretary Babbitt, who, says Cockburn, has managed to say yes and no at the same time. No matter whether over a long-range plan for managing the remaining forests of the Pacific Northwest, in the Everglades of South Florida, or in the case of the California gnatcatcher, a bird whose habitat and very existence is threatened if not endangered, Babbitt is not concerned with the critics. He says his first year in office has been very productive.
Well, I think overall throughout the Clinton administration, it's been an extraordinary year. I mean, we have picked up on the Rio conference and moved on the climate issues, global warming, the biodiversity treaty, beginning to work collectively on the fishing issues, the depletion of fishing stocks in the ocean. I think that, you know, it's writ large that we are committed to working on the global environment. Here at home, I think that the resource issues, It's probably the first time in modern history that we've taken them on all at once. Water, the Northwest forests, grazing, mining. And I think that underlying it is just a simple thing, and that is sustainable use. It's not either or. It's not jobs or the environment, but it is finding the right sustainable level and making sure that we're not making matters worse by pouring subsidies into these uses. Much of that is work in progress. I mean, we haven't brought it all to closure, but I think it's all moving very, very nicely. The third area I would mention is one that's just of great importance to me, and that is this concept of ecosystem management, the use of the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act to try to encourage local governments and villages, communities, states to continually examine how it is we live a little more lightly on the land and how we direct our economic activity within the context of the river valley, the watershed, the ecosystem, so that we have the best of both solid development and a strong, vibrant environment around us.
With those expressions then, looking to 1994, what would be some of the reasonable goals that you would look, you know, shoot for?
Well, obviously I would like very much to take down the work in progress sign on these resource issues, mining, grazing, timber, water, mostly but not exclusively Western issues, and in the place of work in progress, say work complete. We've got the job done. Out on the rest of the landscape, I think we need to spend 94 and the coming years demonstrating that we can find this equilibrium with the help of state and local governments, that we can use the National Biological Survey as a way of having good scientific information so that as we grow and develop, we do it in a way that doesn't create these train wrecks. We do it appropriately because we have information and we can sort of spot the problems while there's time enough and space enough to kind of sit down with everybody and work them out. I really believe that the Endangered Species Act is a wonderfully flexible, broad statute.
Is that coming up on the Hill this year?
I don't know. What I've said to the folks on the Hill is the problem with the Endangered Species Act is not the legislation. It's strong and flexible. It just hasn't been used. And I don't think there's any great urgency about amending it. If they choose to do so, that's fine. But my advice will be the real issue here is in the execution and making it work with our creativity and thoughtfulness and cooperation.
People like Peter Raven in Missouri are concerned to see something strengthened to cover the plant life, which has really kind of been left out of the picture. We've focused too much on the aquatic and land-based animals and left the plants out. Would that be a concern of yours?
Well, we've had some interesting success with plants. The Endangered Species Act accords a lesser degree of protection, but there are still some pretty powerful tools in the Act. My own sense is that, you know, the first thing you try to do is use the public lands as the base for preserving the species and the biodiversity. But we have a lot of other tools. The Land and Water Conservation Fund, land exchanges, all kinds of things. It could be amended and strengthened. But the real opportunity and the real issue is just making it work as it is.
Mr. Secretary, thank you very much.
Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt, pushing aside growing criticism of his style of management by negotiation. To his credit, say a growing number of scientists, Babbitt is right on target when he insists, as he does in organizing the National Biological Survey, that science needs to come before politics, that legislation needs to be informed by scientific principle. Babbitt made his comments during a recent appearance before supporters of U.S. Representative Maurice Hinchey, assembled at the Mohonk Mountain House Resort in New Paltz, New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. That's our report on the Environment Show this week. Thanks for joining us. Make a note, join us again next week at this same time. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for the Environment Show, program number 206. The Environment Show, a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, 1-800-CAR-HERE.